if there's one thing that you want people to walk away with from this chat, I guess what would you want it to be?
I think the bottom-up research approach is probably underrated in a lot of alignment research, where you just try some things that seem somewhat plausible and then see how they pan out and then go from there. I mean, you should think about whether that feedback applies to you, but I think I've seen lots of junior alignment researchers spend like a month reading about alignment, and that's sort of like highly encouraged by the alignment community. You know, there's like tons of writing out there. A lot of it seems like you're making intellectual progress on this, and like it's very critical of different directions. And so you can feel like demotivated and like, oh, this idea, this person had a great critique of this idea. And so maybe it's not worth working on. And so I need to spend like a month or 3 months figuring out what to do. I think just the opposite attitude of like, oh, this seems actually kind of plausible, I can do this fine tuning run in an hour if I sit down and do it in a collab. Then you can like, you are making progress on some problem. And then in parallel, you can kind of figure out like, how should I update this direction to be like also including these results, but also from talking with people, how can I update it to be kind of like more relevant? And that, yeah, I think just if more people on the margin did that, that would be great. Yeah.
Yeah. How about you two introduce yourselves?
I am a researcher at Anthropic, do a lot of external collaborations with other people, like via the Astro Fellowship or Sari Maths. Currently, my team's working on adversarial robustness, and we recently did the sleeper agents paper. So basically looking at, can we use RLHF or adversarial training or current state-of-the-art alignment safety training techniques to train away bad behavior? And we found that in some cases, the answer is no, that they don't train away hidden goals or backdoored behavior in models. So yeah, that was like a lot of my focus in the past like 6 to 12 months. So yeah.
Cool. I'm Mikita. I'm at Apollo. I'm a researcher doing evals for scheming. So trying to look for whether models can plan to do something bad later. Right now I'm in Constellation for a month, where I'm trying to collaborate with others to come up with ideas for next projects and what Apollo should do.
Cool. Yeah. I'm Henry. I guess in theory, I'm the glue between you two, but you also already know each other. So this is in some ways pointless, but I'm one of Ethan's Astro Fellows on that team working on adversarial robustness. Currently, our project is trying to come up with a good fine tuning recipe for robustness. Currently working on API models for just like a sprint, and then we'll move on to open models probably. Cool. So I guess the topic for us to talk about today that we've agreed on beforehand is how to select what research project you do, what are the considerations, what does that process look like? And the rough remit of this conversation is that Ethan and Mikita presumably have good knowledge transfer to be doing, and I hope to make that go better.
Sweet. Let's go.
Okay, great. Mikita, where do you want to start?
Could you tell a story of how you go about selecting a project?
Yeah. In general, I think there's two modes for how I pick projects. So one would be thinking about a problem that I want to solve, and then thinking about an approach that would make progress on the problem. So that's sort of like top-down approach. And then there's a bottom-up approach, which is, well, it seems like this technique or this thing is working, or there's something interesting here, and then following my nose on that. And that's a little bit more like coming from, that's a bit results driven, where it seems like there's, I think a thing might work. I sort of have some high level idea of how it relates to the top level motivation, but haven't super fleshed it out. But it seems like there's a lot of low hanging fruit to pick, and then just like pushing that. And then maybe in parallel or after, like thinking through what problem is this going to be useful for?
At what point do you like think about the theory of change for this?
Yeah, I think just like during the project. I mean, often the iteration cycle is like within the course of a day or something. So it's not necessarily that there's like, if it ends up that the direction isn't that important, that it was like a huge loss. Or sometimes it's like a couple hours or just like a few messages to a model. Sometimes it's just like helpful to have some empirical evidence to like guide a conversation. If you're trying to pick someone's brain about what's the importance of this direction, you might think that it's difficult in some ways to evaluate whether models know they're being trained or tested, which is like pretty relevant for various alignment things. Like you want to know, is the model just doing well on your training or testing distribution, or is it going to do, like, how representative is the training or test performance going to be of the model's behavior in deployment or some other phase? And then I think that's the kind of thing where if you don't really have a specific idea, then it's a little bit hard to talk about it in the abstract. Like, are these situational awareness evals an important direction? Like, a lot of the value of the project depends on the details. And so I think in that case, I've done sort of like, you know, had an idea or woke up with an idea of like, oh, I wonder if I ask this question, is the model going to respond in an interesting way? And then I just like play around with the models, and then, oh, it seems like there's some interesting result here. Now I have like a handle on how I would make some progress on this direction in evaluating situational awareness.
Mm-hmm.
That's like an example of like a high level example of how I've done that. And then maybe like, okay, maybe I just like, I didn't spend like half a day reading into the thinking that people have done on situational awareness or talking with people, but I sort of broadly knew, okay, situational awareness is a thing that people care about. I think I can make progress on this. And so I just kind of go for it.
Yeah, I would like to pick up on that because I'm wondering whether or not you're able to make that kind of decision about experimenting empirically because you have good alignment intuitions. And maybe this isn't advice that would generalize to other people.
I think that's fair. I don't think I have particularly strong or great alignment intuitions. I think I kind of know broadly a bunch of the areas that people think are relevant.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like less opinionated about them than other people. So yeah, I think I'm often in the position where I'm like, yeah, like situational awareness seems probably important. This is the thing that people talk about. Probably some work here would be useful. Generally, lots of the areas in alignment research are empirically bottlenecked in the sense of like lots of people have been talking about a particular area for a while and haven't turned it into an experiment. Maybe because there's some translation that needs to be done from the idea to the experiment. If it seems like you have traction on some general direction that people are talking about, then this is one approach you could follow. If you're doing something that's a new direction, then it's certainly much harder. Yeah, maybe if you were doing sort of like activation steering for the first time, like that's when you'd want to like think a little bit more about what problem is this tackling, that kind of thing. I mean, even in the activation steering case, like I think you could be like, well, you know, guiding the model behavior seems generally important. That's kind of what RLHF is doing. This seems RLHF like, and then do a quick experiment to de-risk it, and then talk with more people after that or brainstorm. But yeah, the other thing that can help is just being in a research environment where there are a bunch of other people who have reasonable intuitions, because you'll just be like drawn more to the like interesting kind of problems. So yeah, I think that's the kind of thing that's like helped me a bunch from being at Anthropic, is that people are like naturally drawn to certain kinds of problems. But you can have that at like lots of other places too.
Yeah, I think that makes sense to me. It sounds like a lot of this is based on either like, as you said, intuitions about what projects are good, or like a sense of what people talk about. Once you have like this kind of, maybe this is already a scoping question. Once you have like this general project idea of like, I want to do activation steering thing, or like I have some interesting prompts for this situational awareness evals, how do you assess whether you want to like commit to this?
So often I'll just write up, here were my like one day's worth of experiments. Here's what I think the motivation is. Here's why I think it's relevant. Then I'll share a doc with other people at Anthropic or outside of Anthropic, and then ask for people's feedback. And then based on some of the specific comments people make and the general reaction, I'll kind of like go from there in deciding whether to continue. That's kind of one mode for this like bottom-up approach.
Yeah, on that, what's the percentage of top-down versus bottom-up that you notice yourself doing, like maybe over the last 6 months?
Yeah, it's a little bit hard to quantify because some projects are a bit of both, where there's a top-down reason we want to do adversarial robustness, for example, but then there's not necessarily a top-down reason for the specific approach, whether or not to train the language model to be adversarial robust, or whether or not, or whether to just have a test time monitor, or whether to use model internals. Like those are things that, yeah, we sort of are like a bit empirical about like which approach we should take, or just kind of, yeah, we take this bottom-up approach a bit of like seeing, oh, it seems like this approach seems like it's kind of working. In parallel, we're kind of like doing some thinking through it, but we don't have like a clear first principles reason why that's like definitely the best way to go. But after we do some amount of that freeform exploration, then we do sometimes switch to, oh, it does seem like given these empirical results, here are a bunch of clear reasons why we should switch to this other approach. So I think it often switches back and forth. So yeah, it's a bit hard to give a number, but it's not clear to me which one we're doing more of. Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like I would probably just put this in the bucket of top down, because like there's the topic and the methods. And here, kind of like you're saying, that the methods are kind of bottom up, but the topic is top down. And like, is it roughly like always kind of the mix is in that shape, that the topic is selected top down?
I mean, I think that this stuff with the situational awareness evals, like mini project that I've done, that was like, I guess I'd read a little bit about why people were interested in situational awareness, but I wasn't like, this is the number one thing on my list of areas where we need alignment progress. I just hadn't like explicitly ranked it. I was like, seems like I can get some interesting evidence on this just from playing around with the models. Maybe I can do a little bit more interesting investigation beyond that, and then wrote it up. So yeah, I think it depends a little bit on like what the research community needs as well. Like sometimes there's just a bunch of low-hanging fruit. For example, yeah, I think around the time of GPT-3, there was just tons of unexplored stuff on language models, and not many researchers were working on language models. Not many alignment researchers were working on language models. So there was just tons of opportunistic stuff you could do. You know, we had this paper on learning from language feedback. Yeah, you can think of that as like an extension of RLHF, but getting a really important modality of human feedback in to be able to incorporate with language models. And that, you know, that's like an example of a thing where I'm sort of like, initially I sort of just tried some initial experiments there in a day or two to kind of like get some signal. I'm like, oh yeah, it does seem like language models can in context learn from language feedback. That kind of should motivate this other algorithm that builds off of that. And so there, if you're in that mode where there's just like tons of low-hanging fruit like that, just being opportunistic can get you a lot farther in a day than kind of like trying to think through the first principle stuff. But if you're in a regime where more work's been done or a lot of that's been picked up, that's the thing that can bias away from the opportunistic stuff. And the other thing that can bias away, like concretely right now, there's just a bunch of safety problems that do need to be solved now before we continue scaling up. I mean, that's kind of the idea behind the responsible scaling plans. And so it's starting to get to the point where if we don't solve adversarial robustness, bad things will actually happen in the world. And so that does actually mean that we do need to sequence problems in a particular way, depending on which problems are going to come up in what order. You know, I think that's like one of the reasons I'm excited about adversarial robustness now, because it's just like, man, pretty soon models are going to be able to be jailbroken and it's actually going to be serious. Bad stuff's going to happen. And that's also relevant to longer term safety risks as well. So that's the thing that can drive more towards the top-down approach.
So it sounds like in the early days of the field, when things are chill, you just kind of can do a bunch of bottom up. But now it's kind of like things are shifting, and depending on your timelines, you probably want to, or where you work, you want to choose different projects.
Yeah, I would say one specific additional thing is that each time there's a new model capability or there's a new model generation, which is clearly more capable than the previous model generation, that's definitely a time to be opportunistic because there's a ton of low-hanging fruit that's not been explored. So yeah, like multimodal capabilities came online, or like code interpreter, or you know, GPT-4, like that kind of thing. Like, I definitely encourage all of my collaborators to like play around with any of the new capabilities that are there, because there's often just tons of low-hanging fruit to pick at that point. Yeah.
What were some of your earliest lessons that you learned about choosing projects, and how have they over time turned out to be wrong?
Yeah, I think that I've gone through phases around how important reading papers or prior work are. So initially I would just like read a bunch. I would spend a month thinking about like what I should work on and reading a bunch of the prior work. And then after that, I sort of like, yeah, fell out of favor on that. I was like, oh, a bunch of the work isn't actually that relevant to alignment, and I'm working on actually like different enough stuff that not all the past stuff is that relevant. Yeah, I think more recently I've gotten to a more nuanced view where, oh, for adversarial robustness, like actually there's just tons of relevant stuff. And there's like specific things that people haven't worked on from the kind of like alignment perspective. But like a lot of the stuff is actually like quite relevant and like very directly relevant. So, and yeah, I think that's also true to some extent about backdoors and sleeper agents. There's like some relevant stuff. So yeah, I think basically now my view is that it's pretty topic dependent, and I would just do a little bit of quick reading before starting in a new area about how much actually relevant stuff has been done, and then, you know, be critical in your evaluation on that. And then you, like, if you're like, oh yeah, it doesn't, I spent a day looking at this, none of the stuff looks like it's actually that relevant, then yeah, I would just be like, yeah, experiments are going to be much more useful, like your own experiments. And then if you do find some interesting stuff, then I would definitely chase that, because it's like free knowledge that's going to be really useful for your stuff.
Cool. So it was like, on priors, you were like, reading papers, very good. Why should I ignore the field? Actually, you were getting a bunch more signal from your own experiments, but as it turns out, within some subfields like robustness, academia or open source community are doing like plenty of work you can borrow from, basically. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, I was kind of nervous halfway through that because I was like, oh man, it's like the classic like rationalist AI alignment researcher take to like not read papers and just like do your empirical work. So cool. Glad for the nuanced opinion to rear its head again. Where are you at in that swing of opinions?
I think probably the reason, I'm guessing that the reason Ethan updated here is not just because of Ethan became a lot more senior and smart. Also that too. But also with time, there has been much more progress in alignment that is empirical, and there's like a lot more work to build on now. There's like control, there are a bunch of evals for like various tendencies and for various capabilities. And now when you start a project, there's just like dozens of less wrong posts to read, a bunch of papers to read, a bunch of people to talk to. Do you feel the same, that like that becomes more relevant with time?
I think that's true, yeah. Definitely the case, yeah.
You and a bunch of others want to start working on something and you're worried that you'll like duplicate work. How much should you care about that at all?
Yeah. This is like other people on the project?
No. Like other people probably at other orgs doing something similar, and you want to like, should we coordinate with them so that we don't do the same thing, or should we like collaborate, or should we like just do independent things? Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. I think my quick take would be very good to sync up with what they're doing in terms of just having a quick 30-minute chat to understand what their angle is. And then I would have the same view as, you know, on related work where you're just like very critical about like, is this actually solving the same kind of problem that we're trying to solve? And I would say almost always it's not, or there's some different angle. I mean, in some exceptions, and hopefully if the field of alignment grows a bunch, then that'll be more the case. But I think often the problem is somewhat different. And so in that case, you can kind of like continue. But if they're working on the exact same problem and they've already made some relevant progress, then yeah, you should just team up or just like switch to some other area.
And when you are kind of both starting the same project, then you're like both drafting docs for how it should go.
Yeah.
Should you try to steer each other to like different directions? Should you try to, agree on what's the right way to do it? Do you want diversity or do you want like alignment here?
I mean, there I would just think about whether you're excited to collaborate with them, and then think about, yeah, do they have the skills that would be relevant and like complementing yours, or just relevant to the project? Do you enjoy getting on with them? Like, yeah. So then if that's the case, then yeah, I think collaboration seems great.
Right. So there's like this another consideration of like, maybe you really like them and you want to work with them, but for some reason you can't work with them. And in that case, if like, for example, you're at different orgs, different time zones or something.
Yeah.
In that case, would you just continue working on this project, or would you like steer away so that two teams don't work on it at the same time?
I mean, I probably in that case, just picking one group to push on it seems good. Yeah. It'll be a tricky conversation probably, but yeah, that's what I've done in the past. Or like my mindset is somewhat like, oh, it seems great that this other group is going to pursue this great idea. That means I don't need to do it. That means I can think about other stuff that I need to do. Yeah, so I'm often just like, wow, it's exciting. I can go do something else. Yeah.
I'm curious, when you're selecting projects, how considerations about collaborators fit in. In particular, how bad is the worst project you'd work on for a really excellent collaborator, or like vice versa? Would you just like never tolerate like a collaborator under a certain bar, but like would work on like some projects if you could work with like some of the best people you know?
I think if you are uncertain about some direction, and then, but you would get to learn from someone who's pretty experienced in some, or yeah, knowledgeable in some area, that seems pretty good. Like I've definitely seen people work with AI safety researchers who have like controversial strong takes, like Dan Hendricks, and then they just like learned so much from Dan because they just got to build a mental model of, oh wow, like he said this thing that was really interesting, and I can tell that they like, when I talk with them next, I'm like, wow, they've learned so much. So I'm highly supportive of that. And then you know, like that's also a way to help you understand like one worldview and then switch to Europe. You might, you know, people have worked with me and then disagreed with my ways of doing research, tragically, and then gone off and, you know, realized like, oh, I actually am interested in this direction. So I think it is actually just like quite helpful for forming your own takes and opinions.
Do you have any project selection grooves that you go through that you would not recommend to others, that are just like the ways that you do this, but this is not like, you wouldn't stand by this?
Probably if you're like a very junior researcher, then the pure bottom-up approach is going to be probably less effective, unless you have kind of a mentor who gives you a good direction or like can give you feedback on what your high-level direction is and that it's well-motivated. My style is like just very empirical, so I think, yeah, I often just encourage people to run an experiment over, yeah, just to like run tons of experiments. And I think that like that's like very useful if experiments are very quick to run and highly informative, which is, for example, that's like a big change from the previous era of machine learning where people had explored like tons of different architectures or whatever. I think now they're like the amount that capabilities have progressed year over year has been like way more rapid than the previous. I mean, it was still rapid in the like post deep learning pre LLM era, but I think it's much more rapid now. So I think this like heavy experimental style is like very useful if you're working, doing stuff that would be like sampling on top of the OpenAI API. I think it's less relevant for potentially other areas. Yeah, I think there depends a little bit on like how much of the low-hanging fruit has been picked in your area. Like if I had collaborators work on image-related adversarial robustness, I'd be like, man, you probably do need to just like spend more time reading some of the past stuff. Yeah, and then I guess the other area where this is less relevant is for more conceptually heavy alignment research. Like, for example, AI control or potentially model organisms research, where, yeah, it is just helpful to get more clarity on, like, what is the exact thing that we want to demonstrate for making a model organism of some new kind of failure. And there, you almost, like, can't get empirical feedback on that in the sense of the uncertainty isn't empirical. It's just, like, what would actually be interesting from a scientific standpoint? What are the research questions we want to answer? Or potentially, like, what are the things that would move the needle on policy? What are the demos that would be interesting to policymakers? So there, the feedback would be more, maybe for the policy thing, you would, like, talk with people who are very in touch with policymakers. Or for the conceptual alignment side, like, Evan Hubinger on the project just, at some point, just took a week and spent some time thinking about what kind of model organisms we should be demonstrating. And that's partly how we got to the sleeper agent's particular model organism, as opposed to other things that I was exploring. So. Yeah, that's I think those are a couple of cases where being like less full on experimental is more the thing you should do.
That makes sense. The way you've talked about the research selection so far is kind of like iterative. But have you ever had like a moment of like aha that completely changed the trajectory?
Yeah. I think it's still pretty iterative when I have moments that change the trajectory of a project. So for example, I was making evaluations for testing, you know, whether models will state that they're power seeking or state that they're whatever, have some other undesirable alignment property, just to like get some rough sense about what models were doing in that space. And then this was just kind of going somewhat slowly, as in like the turnaround time would be like a week. And then
you're writing things.
This wasn't by hand. I would write some by hand and then I would send them to Serge. And then Serge would write a bunch of examples. And they're still like very good at doing that. But it was just like not at this pace. It was not, the project wasn't going at the pace that I wanted to. Then you would kind of need some back and forths with the like crowd workers being like, oh, I realized like this is a harder task to write evals for than I expected. And then at some point, I can't remember what happened, but I just had this strong sense. I was like, man, I feel like LLMs should really just be able to do this. I think they should really, project should just be so much easier and so much faster. And then I just told, like, I remember, like, on Friday, I told a bunch of my collaborators, I was like, I'm going to get models to write the evaluations for me. And then,
You're crazy, man.
The next day, I was like, okay, was starting to sample for models and just being like, can I make the same eval, but with a language model? And then I think, yeah, by the end of the weekend, I had, like, a bunch of working evals.
Damn.
And then I was like, oh, great, this is like so much easier. And I was able to make hundreds of evals. It was, yeah, it made the whole rest of the project so much easier. So that, I think that was partly driven by just butting up against this problem and being like, man, this is really harder than it needs to be. I think, yeah, so that's kind of one case. Maybe another case where I had this with Jeffrey Irving when I was interning at DeepMind, where basically we were thinking about, oh, we want some set of hard questions that we can evaluate models on where we don't know the answers. And this is like a test bed for things like scalable oversight, where we want to be able to evaluate how are models doing on questions where people don't know the answers. And so like it seems good to just make a data set of hard questions where we can run techniques like ASAFTBA debate or iterated amplification and see like have a set of questions where we can kind of see what do the answers look like. Does it look like we're doing a reasonable job on these questions? And so that was like the initial project motivation. And so I basically was, you know, just looking for like, okay, what are the sources of these questions that are out there? There's like lots of like queries from Google that people have released. And so I was looking through data sets like that. And then I was kind of looking through the data sets and not really feeling that excited about the questions they're asking. They're just like pretty factual. People don't ask Google, like, why does God exist and stuff. I mean, some people do, but it wasn't like the main thing that was happening on the Google queries. Then I just started doing more and more complicated stuff, like filtering down these like really large data sets or like maybe considering going through pre-training data. And then I was talking with another collaborator or another person at DeepMind, and they were just like, oh, you know, like, that seems kind of difficult. Like, what, have you tried generating the questions with language models? And I was like, man, yeah, that seems like a great idea. And then right after the meeting, she sent me some generated questions. And I was like, man, these are awesome. These are so great. These are like a great set of really hard questions. You can just ask the language models and they'll give you the questions. I mean, now it sounds so obvious, but I think at the time, that was maybe like 2 years ago. So I think, or maybe even three. So it was just a little bit less obvious, at least to me. And I was less LLM pilled than I am now. Then yeah, that week we just changed the entire project direction to be like generating questions. Yeah, from there we ended up pivoting to this paper of like red teaming language models with language models, where like one of the obvious use cases of this is to like find adversarial vulnerabilities in models. But that was like partly driven by the shift to like generating questions.
I imagine things like this could come up more as models get better. As you said, like when they're like new capabilities, for example, code execution came out and you're just like, yeah, oh, this is a problem that could solve. Sounds like also for that, you need to be like banging with your head against some problem that is like harder without that to like really appreciate the value.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you could go faster towards those solutions than I did. And probably like now I have definitely the instinct where I see people doing a task and I'm like, try to do this with the language model, please. But I think that, yeah, once you realize, oh, this direction, the broad direction of do the same thing you're doing, but automate it with the language model, that high level frame, like, could be applied to like lots of different areas of alignment. Yeah.
Yeah. Are there any things that are like immediate red flags for projects?
Yeah, I think if the experiment loop is going to take more than a day, that's pretty rough because then you can't run experiments overnight and get feedback the next day. Definitely if it's like over a week. Or the other thing that's a red flag is like if there's a fixed cost of a month to run the first experiment, that's pretty rough. Sometimes it will just be like such a good idea that like someone should really do and burn the fixed cost. Like maybe RLHF was like that, where there, I mean, yeah, the fixed cost is plausibly like many FTE months of like competent OpenAI alignment team employees or something. So like, yeah, I think there's like cases like that where you can do it, but it's definitely like by default, it's a red flag and suggests that you should be thinking about simpler ways to run the experiment that still get you similar signal. Yeah, other red flags. I guess I often surface these just by writing a 2-page doc on here's the problem I'm trying to solve and the motivation, here's the potential solution, here are the experiments we would run. And then I send that doc out to a bunch of people and then who are, you know, have takes on AI safety that I respect or, you know, maybe like familiar with different experimental details about how easy this would be to run or whatnot. And then that kind of then I'll just like get a bunch of comments and then often at that stage of the project, the most relevant feedback would be like, even if this project were extremely successful, it wouldn't be that important. Yeah, I think, for example, like people at Redwood Research give really good feedback on along this kind of vein. So I've like learned a bunch from chatting with them and I like share a bunch of my project docs with them. So that, yeah, I think sort of like both on the project importance aspect and the like, is this going to be easy to do aspect is like probably the two main places where flags come up.
Is there any way to like reduce the fixed cost for future versions of you or for other people? Is there any like infra that could be built up that you wish was there? For example, you find missing when you like do outside collaborations?
Good RLHF infra. That's a known correct implementation that works really well. That would be pretty valuable.
There is TierLX, which gives you.
I'm not familiar with how good the current stuff. It's possible there is like some existing stuff out there that's very good, but I think it's very tricky to get a good PPO implementation or whatever algorithm implementation for LLMs, then, you know, then making it more efficient is also a big thing. It's like quite slow. And then also making it so that, you know, the hyperparameters work well by default, and like you don't need to do a bunch of tuning, like that's also pretty helpful. So it's possible there's something out there. Like my current knowledge based on vibes from my external collaborators is that there's not anything that's like a slam dunk here. But yeah, it's possible that improving on stuff like TRLX seems good. And I'm excited that they're doing the kind of stuff they're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. What's the way to improve that if you like don't have a baseline that works? How do you know that it is like a correct implementation?
This is hard. I think having a person who knows what they're doing and is like, I don't know, has done it before, that's helpful. I don't know if I have great tips here because I haven't implemented RLHF from scratch. Yeah.
Anything outside of that? Other infra?
Not really in general. I think it just kind of changes a lot, like every 6 months, what kind of thing would be helpful generally. I think for a while it was harder to fine-tune models, and then OpenAI had the fine-tuning API, which made it extremely easy to just write a function call and then you can fine-tune. And also it even sets the hyperparameters in pretty reasonable ways. So like that made things a bunch easier for my external collaborators. I think probably stuff like LangChain was helpful in unblocking some of the people I worked with.
Right. A thing that I find missing sometimes is like a playground for open source models.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like a big reason why I don't like play with them as much as with OpenAI.
Yeah,
because they just have a playground.
So when should you switch off a project?
Yeah, I think one trap projects commonly fall into is that they're making some progress, but not like fast enough. So they seem like maybe promising, but it's not, there's no like clear result that shows this is really working. That can also often be like big time sink because there's just a lot of interesting, or there's a lot of stuff that seems like it might work, but yeah, kind of hasn't hit strong point yet. There, it's really helpful. I find it really helpful to think about what are some other promising projects I could be doing, and then having a clear sense in my mind of like, here are what the alternatives are. Because I think in the middle of a project, it's easy to be thinking, oh, like this is net useful, which is true. Like you would make progress on your current project by continuing to work on it. But I think knowing what the counterfactual is relative to a different project is pretty helpful. And then also just makes it like easier emotionally to switch, where you're switching not because you're like, oh, this doesn't seem like it's working out, but more because, oh, I'm like more excited about this other direction. So yeah, in the case of the like model written evaluations project that I discussed earlier, like that was, I was sort of like making, like asking Serge to make these evaluations in the background, like 20% of my time while I was like focusing on another project. And that project like had some results, but then I was like, man, I feel like this evaluation process should be much easier. Then when I did this like prototyping over the weekend, it was so much clearer, like, wow, this direction is way more promising than the other stuff I was doing. And then I just like, it wasn't even a question for me to continue the other project because I was like, well, I have these much more promising results. I should just continue to push on those. Yeah, I think that's one case for like how to know when to switch projects is if you have something else that's more promising.
From there, it sounds like your situation wasn't to stop your only project and think about alternatives. It sounds like you were working on like at least one more project at the time, which like allowed you to have this visibility, like awareness. Is that something you'd recommend, basically?
I mostly for junior researchers wouldn't recommend splitting projects because it's like very hard to even do one project well. And that basically requires like very full-time effort. I think that, basically like each project has a fixed cost. The fixed cost is like larger if you're a new researcher in the sense of like you currently have like less context in the whole field. And so if you're doing like 20 hours a week on a project as a like first-time researcher, that's closer to like a net output of zero. And like all the gains come kind of like super linearly after that point. Once you're doing like 30 hours a week, then you have this like net 10 hours a week that you're able to contribute to the project because you have all the states and you're going to all the meetings and you have read all the papers and then you're able to like do the right things. And then once you're, you know, going 60 plus hours a week, then you like really have, you know, you have like the whole code base in your mind. It's like easier. It's like all your like thoughts are cached. You've like just have so much state from talking with the other collaborators. You've already like run a bunch of relevant experiments that are like easy to build off of. So you've just like paid down the fixed cost, and then there's like a bunch of these additional benefits. Maybe your like experiments have been working, so you're like more motivated. You've been able to like talk with other people and get feedback, and they've given you great ideas. Like, you're basically able to leverage all the stuff you did in the fixed cost time to make all of your other future work like that week go even better. So
yeah, so how does that wrap around back to what junior researchers should be doing when it comes to project selection, especially with Makita's question of like projects that might not be working or something?
Yeah, I think there you can at least talk with people about what other directions seem promising without actually having to run the experiments. Like, one of the things that was like harder, at least for me early on, is running experiments quickly, because I was like, whatever, just picking up how to code and stuff like that. So there it was sort of like more costly for me to run the experiment. Some of the experiments I had in mind were like pretty costly to run the first one. And so they're just like talking with other people and getting excited about some other direction, being like, oh, here, I can actually write the 2-page version of this project. And it seems like it is interesting to other people. That's, you know, that's often the kind of thing that doesn't take that much extra effort per week. And then once you're at that point, then yeah, you could potentially be like, okay, I'm like explicitly going to pause this other project and spend like a week de-risking this other idea, or this new model came out and it seems like it would, you know, make AI safety via debate much more easy to run experiments on. So I'm going to like now do that or whatever. And then after that week, you can assess like, does it make sense to continue on this?
Right. So it sounds like you just shouldn't be siloed, and then should like think about other projects, yeah, like to people.
Yeah.
Ethan, Makita, thanks so much for coming. It was really great to do this.
And yep. Yeah. Thank you, Henry.
I'm going to see you outside when we go back to our work day, I guess, after this.
Cool. Thanks for hosting. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks.